With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
To say that was a low point would be an understatement, really. But one of those things where, you know, I remember being horrifically sort of hungover in a police cell and just thinking, how did this happen?
Hello there, welcome to another edition of the Dan Wotton Interview, where the biggest names in showbiz come to reveal all. And in this edition, I'm delighted to sit down with one of my favourite bands, fresh from their triumphant comeback at Glastonbury. Yes, it's hard to believe, but after nearly 6 years away, is it any wonder fans have been begging for more Keane? Well, finally, they've got their wish. But it has to be said, the road to reunion hasn't been smooth. Frontman Tom Chaplin's relapse after going to rehab for cocaine addiction in 2006 signalled the end of Keane, and his friendship with bandmate Tim Rice-Oxley as well, who also suffered his own drink-driving incident and a marriage breakdown as he battled depression. So the pair worked hard to heal their rift, and now they're exercising their demons on Keane's brand new album Cause and Effect, which they hope will become their sixth UK chart topper. Today, they open up about their reunion and everything they've had to go through to get here. It's a deep one. And if you do like this episode, please do rate 5 stars and review. It will allow more people to find the pod. Remember to subscribe as well. There are some amazing names with fascinating stories like Madonna, Celine Dion, Dolly Parton, and Kylie Minogue. So you'll want to make sure you never miss a new episode. And if you subscribe, you'll get them as soon as they become available. But for now, let's go. Up close and in depth, here's Keane. Welcome to the pod. Tom and Tim both here. And it's actually so exciting to have you together because, well, Tom knows I'm obviously a massive Keane fan, but Tom, you were predicting even just a couple of years ago that this would never happen.
I'm still kind of pinching myself that we're here doing stuff. You know, I'm doing interviews and on the stage and it's Keane, right? I think it has really taken me by surprise in a way. As you say, sort of, I was doing my solo stuff and really enjoying it and felt it was very rewarding creatively.
Such an amazing album.
Well, thank you. Yeah, and I really felt happy in that place. But the one thing that I knew was missing in my life was seeing my old friend Tim, you know, and I hadn't seen him for ages. And yeah, I sort of got in touch and said, you know, come over and we'll sit by the fire and have a chat. And it was Christmas time and Tim arrived with a stomach bug, so we couldn't have lunch. So we ended up just sitting and talking and inevitably got onto the subject of music. And then Tim sent me all of these songs that he'd been writing. And I just felt, you know, I think when you're a musician, artist, whatever, you have to go where you feel there's a kind of creative energy or creative draw. And it just felt like these songs were so full of life and beauty and sadness and vulnerability and all those things. I just felt, wow, this is where I want to go. And so that was a sort of the beginning of being back here. But it was a big surprise to me.
And Tim, is it true that you hadn't seen each other or spoken for 2 years before that meeting at Christmas?
It's possible. I can't really remember.
I don't think it was. I think we'd been to Sarah's wedding, hadn't we, in France?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I think it probably felt like that because obviously we've seen an awful lot of each other for a long time, you know, long before we were signed and we were friends. We've been friends our whole lives. So I suppose to suddenly sort of like come out of warp speed almost and, you know, then even if you see someone once every few months or exchange the odd message or whatever it is, you know, that's still a big change from having seen each other every every day.
And so was there negativity? Was there bad blood between you? What was your personal relationship like to not have spoken or at least been in close contact for that amount of time? Or was it just that you needed to have some time apart?
It's hard to know, isn't it? I sort of felt like 2012-13, well, on one part, I had this strong desire to do something on my own creatively, because Tim's always been the songwriter of Keane and written some amazing and classic songs, and it's been a great privilege to be a part of that. But I did feel, you know, for me, I wanted to kind of express myself through songs and wanted to take the time out to do that. But I think also there was another part to it that you know, I suppose I talked about a lot with the solo record, which is there was definitely a part of me that wanted to go and completely self-destruct and probably needed the safe space of not being committed to anything or to other people.
Because
in order to
you
do
would
that.
Potentially
yeah, but
let
it's so
them
destructive.
Down.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I don't think whether I knew that consciously.
But it's subconscious.
Yeah, exactly. So there was that as well.
Because in terms of the writing of the songs, right, because obviously, Tom, on The Wave, you've written all of these incredible songs, but with Keane, you have never thought about writing together. It's always been the case, Tim, that you write the songs and, Tom, you sing the songs.
Yeah, well, I say yes. I mean, it hasn't always been the case. When we, for many years, you know, we both wrote and we had a guitarist as well, Dominic, who used to write songs. So it wasn't like it was sort of enshrined in any way, but it just sort of became, you know, I just had a sudden surge of songwriting, which... this is going to sound like
they were better. Honestly. Those songs were better than anything that Dominic and I.
Well,
write,
I guess,
which I think is was the truth at the time.
Yeah, I suppose they ended up becoming the first album, didn't they? And then
I
think
you always
it became,
liked writing on your own, presumably.
Yeah, too. I did. I mean, it's not that I. Well, I suppose then lots of things happened. Like, for example, I found that obviously we were hugely lucky with our first album, and it became this massive thing. Mm. But then we were touring and touring and touring, and I felt very under pressure to write the second album. You know, I can remember us talking about this in the past, but, you know, I then sort of felt quite defensive about the writing, I think, which, you know, in turn was then difficult for Tom because he probably wanted to do writing. So, you know, then you end up in one of these sort of massive dysfunctional, passive-aggressive relationships.
But I guess you had a successful formula, though.
Yeah,
and
that is
so
true,
the question was... Why disrupt that, I guess?
I suppose, I mean, it is definitely true that there's something that works about it, isn't there? And I can't really explain that because I don't have any delusions of grandeur about my own writing. But for example, we did some writing together for this new album and it was great fun. I really enjoyed it a lot. But I am, for some reason, not very good at writing with other people. I've done, in the last few years when we've not been doing Keane stuff, I've written with other people a lot. And I just never feel like, with a few exceptions, I never feel like I've come up with my best stuff that way. I know it must be something about me that's not very good at collaborating, or I think I clam up too much or something. So,
yeah, well, that makes sense because they are such personal songs that you tend to write and quite deep and emotional. True. And so I guess you're going to a place that is maybe slightly awkward to do when there are other people there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I lack... confidence, I suppose, is the truth of it. So, you know, I need to sort of shut myself away and I'll write for 12 hours straight and maybe something good will come out, but I have to almost be in a kind of trance to get to that place where something good comes out. And it's hard to do that with someone, you know, even Tom, you know, but again, you know, it's the processes that make a band good are sometimes just inexplicable. You know, probably... Well, not probably. I'm pretty certain that the fact, if I know I'm writing songs, knowing that I'm like trying to impress Tom and the other guys as well with them, you know, it changes the way I write and it definitely makes me step up.
And Tom, I guess you must feel quite assured coming back in that you have now proven yourself as a great songwriter too.
Well, I'd say I definitely in many ways feel different, you know. Part of the kind of self-destructive process was, you know, taking myself to that point. But from there, I did a lot of, you know, there's been a lot of kind of self-repair and reflection and changing the way I do things. And yeah, learning a kind of different vocabulary for expressing myself and seeing the world in a different way. So I sort of feel like a person who, you know, I like myself more. I'm probably a little bit more outgoing in a way and honest with people than I used to be. And I think that has definitely, yeah, I sort of feel like I bring that into the world of Keane, you know, which I probably didn't in the past. I maybe could end up feeling isolated or not worthwhile at times. And so, yeah, so be able to bring that into Keane is really, it's lovely. It's really, really refreshing, actually.
And the result seems pretty amazing. I mean, the album's called Cause and Effect. There's 11 new songs on the main album. I've been able to listen to 5 of them for the past couple of weeks. And they are so timeless and very classic Keane. I mean, the 2 songs in particular, The Way I Feel and Stupid Things, for me, are very, very amazing, strong Keane songs. So it's a brilliant record, I think. I mean, the other 6 tracks would have to be pretty bad to go down in isolation, which I'm sure they're not.
Shuffle, delete, repeat.
Now, this is when you have to make choices between your own songs, which people sometimes do find very hard, actually. So we've got 2 categories for Keane. So we're going to kick off with Keane ballads. The first
They're
choice...
all ballads, aren't they?
No, you know, come on.
No.
Some are slightly more upbeat. But no, in terms of ballads, Somewhere Only We Know, 2004, of course. One of the biggest hits of that year, a platinum single and recently covered by Lily Allen for the John Lewis Christmas advert. This could be the end of everything. So why don't we go somewhere only we know?
Somewhere only we know. Somewhere only we know.
Also from 2004, Bedshaped, from Hopes and Fears, another top 10 single in the UK singles chart. You'll follow me back with the sun in your eyes and on your own. Bedshaped, legs of stone. You'll knock on my door and up we'll go in white light. I don't think so. What do I know? I know. And from 2006, Nothing in My Way, from the album Under the Iron Sea, also a top 20 single in the UK. So out of those 3 Keane ballads, which would you shuffle, which would you delete, and which would you repeat?
Oh, my goodness. Well, funnily enough, Nothing in My Way. When we've come back, obviously, we've had a long break,
yeah,
and we've come back to playing again. And we were kind of going through the old songs that we'd like to kind of dust off and start playing again. And we talked about Nothing in My Way, and we were a bit like, well, yeah, we quite like that one, but there wasn't that much love for it. But then we were looking through, this is something we didn't have the benefit of like 7 or 8 years ago, was the Spotify numbers.
Mm.
And like Nothing in My Way is right up there with all the Keane songs amongst the fans. So you can find out
favorite.
It's a fan favourite. So we had to dust it off and it completely changed my opinion of the song. No, Bedshaped in some way I just love so much,
yeah,
that I think I would probably jettison Nothing in My Way.
Yeah, it's deleted. Yeah. It's agreed. Gone. And so which would you repeat out of Somewhere Only We Know and Bedshaped?
I think we've had Somewhere Only We Know on repeat probably throughout our adult lives, haven't
yeah.
we, already?
Yeah, waking and sleeping. It's playing on a loop.
So maybe shuffle that one and repeat Bedshaped?
Yeah.
Are you up for that?
I'd agree. I love Bedshaped.
Yeah.
I think it's obviously when you're sort of in the band and you record a song and then you're playing it every night and stuff, you almost sort of stop hearing it. If that makes any sense.
Totally,
and
I can imagine that.
Sometimes, you know, as Tom says, with a little bit of a break, and then you go back and listen to the old songs, you know, it's quite a weird song, and it's got these weird sounds, and it sort of goes from super tiny to absolutely massive in the chorus, in this kind of sort of it's like a Nirvana ballad.
it is. It's so haunting.
And it's great to play live. It just sort of goes off every time. So
now, these are Keane bangers. Okay, proper bangers from Keane. The options are Everybody's Changing from 2003, also from your debut album, reached number 4 in the UK singles chart. Under the Iron Sea, Is It Any Wonder, charted number 3 in the UK from 2006. Probably my favourite Keane song, but it's a tough choice there. But Spiraline from 2008 from the album Perfect Symmetry won a Q Award for Best Track of the Year. Those three Keane bangers, which would you shuffle, which would you delete, and which would you repeat?
Oh, that's a tough one. Oh, go on, you go.
No, you go, you start, you start.
Well, I love all of those. I particularly love Spiraling. I think...
What a song.
You're always quite pleased when you do something where you feel like we've really done something out of our comfort zone there.
Yeah.
And even now I listen to that one and think, what were we thinking with that song?
And it's weird with that one.
Career a big shot in the arm, didn't it? Because it showed that you could do something quite different on that.
Well, exactly.
Album.
At that point, when we made that record, we released Spiraling as I think they call it something dreadful, like an instant grat these days. So before the record comes out, it's like a little freebie. We were putting all our hopes on a single that was going to come after that.
Which one?
I think it was The Lovers Are Losing, wasn't it?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
That was going to be the main first single.
Keane, you would
say. Exactly. But, because we thought Spiraling, it's a bit sort of left field or different for us or something, but we thought it was nice, interesting kind of curiosity. We put it out, and there was a really sort of strong and positive reaction to it, wasn't it? And suddenly we were like, we had to kind of chase our tails a bit to try and get a video made for it, because we realised, well, actually, this should be the song that leads the record.
So you're going to repeat Spiraling.
Yeah.
So then which do you delete out of Everybody's Changing or Is It Any Wonder?
I can't delete Everybody's Changing. It's going to have to be Is It Any Wonder.
Yeah, it's a tough one.
Yeah, which feels a shame, really.
I just would like to talk to each of you, actually, independently, a bit about that journey for the past few years. So, Tom, why don't we start with you? Because... Okay. You have obviously hinted already at the fact that when you left Keane in 2013, you almost felt like something bad was coming, and then something bad did come.
Yeah.
You know, you've been very open about the fact that you did relapse again. And then since then, you have said that you feel it's only songwriting and pursuing the solo career that was able to keep you off drugs. So tell me about that process over the past few years and where you've come to now, because obviously anyone who knows about addiction knows that this is not something that just goes away. You know, it is a lifelong process for people to go through.
I think it is. Yeah, I don't know whether it's the songwriting and that is the thing that keeps me sober. I think that's one of the really lovely kind of byproducts of being sober. You know, it's that it allows you the time, the energy, and I guess the kind of mental clarity that you need to be able to write songs. So, but also, I mean, that applies to all parts of life as well. It's not just the songwriting. Like a much happier family life than I had before, because I've got same things, time for my daughter and my wife and energy to kind of do stuff with them and be there, be present and be someone who they can trust. So I put most of it down to the therapy that I had. An incredible therapist who I've been seeing for over 10 years. I see him every week, pretty much without fail. And he knows me as well as anyone, really. And I've shared all my kind of deepest, darkest secrets and traumas and things that have held me back in the past. And to have a person like that in my life, you know, doesn't judge and, you know, provides me with that safe space, has allowed me to be a much happier, more confident, and ultimately, hopefully at least, have kind of dealt with my demons of addiction for the rest of my life. So from that starting point, when you have that, then the rest of it kind of just flows out of it, really. It's not, you know, life doesn't seem like as anything like the ordeal that it used to for me. I mean, it's still tough days and tough times and challenges, but really I feel like it has given me this kind of very stable platform and you know, so much good stuff flows out of that. So you know, from that point on, why would I want to go back to kind of a mad self-destructive existence?
And I mean, is it unhappiness that causes it, or is it pressures of fame, or is it just the fact that if you are addicted to something, you're addicted to something?
Oh, I think it's multiple. It's multiple things. It's layers and layers of different things, I think, contribute to it. I would be surprised, unless you have a very significant traumatic experience in your life. I think for someone like me, there have been many different things that have fed into that addictive process. I would say it's been about understanding all of those things and coming to terms with them.
And on a more, I guess, political level, there's been a lot of discussion about this whole issue lately. You know, how damaging are drugs? Does there need to be overwhelming legalization of drugs to be able to tackle the issue properly? Right. Where do you stand on that as someone who has experienced the real dark sides and lows?
I mean, the current system doesn't work, does it? Let's be honest. The war on drugs has been a complete failure and continues to be and always will be. For me, you know, you look at somewhere like Portugal and drugs have been decriminalised there and all of the signs and the evidence is that that's a very positive thing, that it makes a real difference when you can use that money to kind of help educate people. And, you know, so as soon as you kind of point the finger of blame and you kind of make it something that's, you know, even the description, like the war on drugs or whatever, you know, those kind of negative connotations or, as soon as you make the issue something that's sort of just full of negative connotations, and it seems to make it worse. So I think it's about trying to find positive ways of solving these problems. And the fact is there are plenty of people around the world who use drugs on a recreational basis, and it doesn't have a, you know, impact on their lives.
I guess the concern is, though, for some people it does. And how do you know before you're down that rabbit hole? And just finally on this point, I wonder if you feel like the entertainment industry needs to look at itself at all, because obviously you came into this industry a pretty young man at the same time as some people who we have lost through drugs. Yeah. I guess the most notable and most horrific example of that being Amy Winehouse. But, you know, there is this attitude. I mean, I remember at the time people like Liam Gallagher saying to you, oh, you're a lightweight because you ended up in rehab, you know? Yeah. And to me, that feels like the total wrong approach.
Yeah.
You know, you're not hard enough if you have a problem with drugs.
But I think those things have begun to change. And obviously there's much more of a sensible discussion about mental health going on in the media these days. You know, people understand these things better. I think, that's probably part of the answer is helping people to understand where these problems come from, you know, whether it's depression, anxiety, or addiction, or any kind of mental health issue.
And I guess fame just makes it a lot worse.
Well, it maybe it does, but then there are lots of people who aren't famous who are succumbing to the same problem.
So you don't feel like there's any systemic issue in the music industry? Do you see what I mean? In the entertainment industry? Because it does seem to be something that musicians have to deal with so
it's
much
full of,
more.
It's the industry, music industry is full of people who are very sensitive.
Yeah.
And part of the motivation for being a musician or anyone in creative arts,
of course,
is that you have to have, well, on one hand, you have to have a very thin skin, you know, you have to be able to create and be vulnerable and open yourself up. But then you have to kind of put it out there into the big wide world, which requires a thick skin, you know, and receive all the criticism and be under scrutiny and all of that stuff. So it's a very weird world that you're putting yourself in because there's such a dissonance between the two sides of it. And so I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised that there are people who fall victim to it, but I don't know whether it's a systemic thing. It's that would be, I'm not really the right man to ask about that. I just think there are a lot of, yeah, like I say, a lot of sensitive souls in this world.
The five.
Each week, I ask my guests about the five songs that mean the most to them. So maybe it could be a song that inspired you to write and play music, or one that brings back special memories, or maybe even a song you'd love to cover. So recently we've had Nick Grimshaw. He chose Dr. Dre, which he rapped along to at his school leavers ball. Tom O'Dell, he chose Bruce Springsteen as it was his driving home song. And then on the last pod, Tove Lo, she had her fellow Swede, obviously Robin, in her five as it was who she would try to emulate when she was learning to sing. So obviously we've got the two of you today. So what we're going to do, Tom, is get two songs from you, two songs from Tim, and then you're going to have to agree on the final one as like the keen choice. So, Tom, what is your first choice for the five?
So my first choice, I think it is, well, is The Divine Comedy and a song called A Lady of a Certain Age. I just think Neil Hannon is one of the great storytellers in pop music and one of the great lyricists. And I think probably they're kind of known, or he's known as maybe, because the bigger singles that have kind of hit the mainstream have kind of had a slight sort of novelty quality. So I think he's maybe a bit underestimated by the general public. But I think when you know his music and you get really into the sort of nuts and bolts of it, there's just so many amazing songs. But this song, A Lady of a Certain Age, it just tells a story about this woman who's sort of, you know, was a big socialite and has fallen on hard times. And it's just such a magical idea to write about, and some beautiful melodies, so well observed. And in fact, I believe that the story has prompted a whole novel that sort of someone was inspired to write on the back of the song. So I'm always trying to champion Neil's cause because I think he's wonderful.
Let's have a listen.
Until the light of youth became obscured and left you all alone and in the shade,
Song two
is a song that we've covered before as a band. And when we first sort of came on the scene back in 2004, people always used to say, oh, you guys would love the Blue Nile. You've got a certain touch of the Blue Nile about you. I don't think any of us really knew Blue Nile at that point. So, you know, over the years I started listening to their music, and there's very little of it because they've got a very sort of snail's pace in terms of making records and releasing them. So I think in like 30 years it's been four and a half records. I mean, the music is mesmerising. There's beautiful kind of cinematic soundscapes that they conjure up. And then Paul Buchanan's voice is this kind of beautiful, kind of crooning, silky, gorgeous voice, so emotional. And the songs are very often kind of they're like a sort of patchwork of image, and very often sort of songs about sort of cityscapes and quite impressionistic. But the one I'm choosing is called The Downtown Lights, which is, I guess, more of a classic love song, and I've loved covering this with Keane, but the original version just stirs my heart every time.
Oh, well, let's listen.
How do I know it's true? It's all right. It's all right. The downtown light.
Thank you, Tom. Now, Tim, can you give me your two tracks to add to the five?
My first choice is Always On My Mind by the Pet Shop Boys.
Oh, wow.
Or their cover of it, I should say, because that was the song that really opened my eyes to pop music, having been brought up on basically a diet of kind of opera and a few old LPs from the 60s of my parents' collection of like Buddy Holly and the Beatles and I think Bridge Over Troubled Water were probably the three off the top of my head. And basically knew nothing about pop music. It just wasn't really in our home particularly. And then I went on holiday. We went on a family holiday with another family, my best friend Owen, and he had this tape of Now 11. And he put it on in the car. He said, "Oh, you've got to hear this song." And the first song on it was always on my mind, and it had just been Christmas Number One. And I just thought it was amazing. It was so full of energy and, I don't know, so sort of almost kind of wittily bombastic or something, yeah. Just so carefree. And I just absolutely fell in love. I remember listening to it over and over and over again. Basically, that sort of opened the door to my love of pop music.
Amazing. Well, let's have one more listen. What is your second choice?
My second choice is There Is a Light That Never Goes Out by The Smiths, because, again, I think it was a really crucial song in our development as a band, and certainly my development as a writer. I think just sort of discovering a band, I always felt, before I knew anything about The Smiths, I thought they just always seemed to be really cool, and I thought, I'm not going to get this when I listen to it. Then we just went through, I remember Tom and I were living together up in Stamford Hill, and we just got really into Smiths. I just remember listening to Smiths all the time, loving their sort of the melodies and the lyrics and the sort of quite 60s influence pop songs. And that, you know, this song in particular is so, so emotional. It's funny. It's sort of incredibly English, incredibly full of character and detail, but also, you know, really sincere and such a beautiful love song. And I suppose it from that point onwards, I felt like we sort of changed direction a lot and were sort of emulating that kind of writing a lot more.
Okay, here we go. And guys, one song you have to choose together. Can you do that?
I think we can.
Of Keane, okay? Yeah.
Well, it's funny Tim was talking about that time when we were living together, yes, in London. We were desperately trying to get a record deal. It was sort of around the turn of the millennium. So, yeah, we were doing the kind of Camden circuit. And every band, pretty much, at that point had electric guitar, bass, drums, and probably a front man with an acoustic that, you know, and was trying to be Radiohead, because they were just they had such a massive impact on everyone. Like the Bends and OK Computer, just two of the greatest records of all time, but in our lifetimes, right? We weren't looking back to the 60s anymore and thinking, you know, let's try and write records like the Beatles. It was suddenly there in front of us. And so everyone, I think, at that point was trying to be like them. So we've chosen a song called Airbag, which is the opening track of OK Computer.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?"
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And Tim, you were having, I guess, a much more quiet battle over the past few years, a lot of which you have poured into these new songs, which include some really, really, I guess, soul-bearing lyrics on your part about your own life. Tell me about what you've been going through and the experience that you've had since Keane split in 2013.
It was an unfortunate, maybe not a coincidence, but at the same time as we stopped doing Keane, basically my marriage sort of fell apart. Those two things basically coincided. And it's never a great thing to happen. But yeah, I suppose I was dealing with, a lot of heartbreak and, a totally new life that I really hadn't planned for.
Well, I guess two massive changes to your life.
Yeah, and I've, definitely Keane has been, maybe inevitably, just such a huge part of my life and, really an obsession, I suppose.
Yeah, of course.
Since, I don't know how old we were, early 20s or whatever. And, not just a sort of obsession in my mind, but also a lifestyle where you're used to living out of a suitcase and eating in the hotel restaurant every morning. and suddenly I was sort of alone in this empty house that I'd, all the time we'd been touring the last album, I'd been, we'd been renovating this lovely little house in the countryside. And, I thought, well, that's where I'm going to be with my family forevermore. And then suddenly I'm in this sort of empty house with no bed and realizing that I'd never learned to, fry an egg or,
You were on your own.
Yeah, very, very much on my own. And I suppose that's what this album is about, really. Firstly, how I got there, and secondly, how I reacted to it. And, and it's something that people go through. It's married or otherwise, it's a relationship disappearing. And it has a huge impact on you, especially when you're, I would have been in my late 30s, I suppose, mid 30s. It's a bit different from when you're 18. It's like really your life takes a massive right turn or left turn or whatever, and you're not suddenly not going where you thought you were going to be.
It has been suggested in the past, Tim, that the pressure of being in Keane was the result of your relationship ending. Do you put it down to that?
Yeah, I think a lot of it. It's funny, we always used to say that, the going away is probably like quite a good thing. I think, maybe everyone feels that sometimes, that you can get take each other for granted a bit when you're sort of living together and seeing each other, doing a sort of a daily grind. And we always used to think, oh, that's quite nice that you have been away for a bit and you come back and it sort of everything feels a bit fresh and you've had a bit of a break from each other. But I think over 10 years or something, that actually, it's not a good thing, because you start to live independently and, sort of start living separate lives almost. And certainly with us, by the time we realized it was,
it's too late.
It was too late, basically.
And that's one of the really hard parts of the industry. And then you were arrested for drink driving.
Yeah.
You ended up with your car in a ditch. I mean, what happened? Do you remember? Do you know what you were going through at that point?
Yeah, I think, you know, that was to say that was a low point would be an understatement, really. But, you know, one of the good things about the last few years, I've had this house in the down in Sussex and, you know, met some really lovely people. There's a lovely community of friends and sort of centred around my local pub. And we used to, you know, get together and have kind of sing songs. Mm. It was a really supportive group of people. And but then unfortunately at that, a few years ago, whenever it was 2015, maybe 14, 15, my friend who was a landlord decided, you know, to move on. And suddenly that whole community was sort of gone. And it was actually the night of his, it was like something, you know, it was like a sort of very dramatic, you couldn't have written it any better, but it was the night of his sort of leaving do. And I think I sensed this another, you know, big part of my life was disappearing, that little community of friends. And yeah, anyway, I just drank way too much. And, you know, I don't know what I was doing. Obviously just sort of completely idiotic behaviour, but I don't know what happened. Fell asleep at the wheel or something. It's just sort of one of those things where, you know, I remember being horrifically sort of hungover in a police cell and just thinking, you know, how did this happen? How did I go from being this sort of super sensible guy with, you know, a wife and two kids and, you know, almost sort of, you know, I think I always felt quite proud or something, you know, maybe almost a little self-satisfied with, you know, how sort of neatly arranged my life had been, you know, in a successful career, nice little house in the countryside, lovely family, and suddenly, you know, you're sort of on your own in a police cell, separated and no career. And
so the ultimate wake-up call, maybe.
Yeah, it was pretty grim, and that's, you know, I've put that into one of the songs on the album, Strange Room. You know, it's very much about that, and it's...
Well, there's a lyric, I know what it looks like, rich kid with a good life.
Yeah.
Is that how you felt, that people would see your life and assume he's got it all?
Yeah, very much so. And I think, you know, as Tom was saying, the thing about, you know, trying to learn a bit about your own mind, I suppose it's been nice to try and write a little bit about what goes on in your head as a... It's almost a sort of truism, but it, you know, it just doesn't matter how rosy things appear to be.
You never know.
You're going to have stuff going on in your head. And that, yeah, that song, I suppose I'm trying to, you know, trying to say things fall apart very easily. You know, it's a very delicate structure that holds us all up.
Mm. And how are you doing now? Have you been able to move on? Is there anyone else in your life?
Yeah, I'm feeling pretty good. I mean, it's, I think I've sort of been through a phase of kind of casting around and making terrible decisions and feel a bit more stable now. I mean, one of the good things about the whole period is that it's made me focus on being a dad, maybe. You know, I always thought I was a good dad, but actually when there's always someone else there to kind of do the grunt work and you can come and go and you can go on tour and there's always someone to sort it out. You know, now it's like if I don't, I don't know, whatever, you know, cook with dinner or do a school run, you know, it's not going to get done. And I absolutely love it. And I, you know, that's sort of very much the focal point of my life now. And it's such an enriching experience as it, you know, always should be.
No, absolutely.
Firsts.
Let's do Tim for first. So first concert you went to?
U2, Zoo TV.
First job?
First job, I worked in a nursing home.
First instrument you played?
Piano.
First thing you put on your rider requests?
Probably like bananas or something suitably mundane.
First album you bought?
First album I bought was a Disco by the Pet Shop Boys.
Last.
Tom, to you, last album that you loved?
Oh my goodness. God, I can't remember the guy's name. Thundercat, there we go.
Last song that you wrote?
I wrote one yesterday at home.
Amazing. Last thing you did on a whim?
Went up on the London Eye, and I'm terrified of heights, and it was the most stupid thing. I thought, because I'm all right in a plane, I'll be all right on the London Eye. And I literally gripped the kind of chair in the middle for the entire duration.
Really, but
of
you
it.
Feel so safe in there, I think.
I was horrendous. And I was with my 5-year-old. She was kind of leaning on the windows, which kind of made it feel even worse. It was terrifying.
And the last item you ordered from Amazon.
I know. It was a. This is going to sound very niche. It was like kind of one of those wires to hang a net curtain on. Because this is a long story. I'm not going to go into it.
Tom, have you seen Rocket Man?
I haven't yet. No. I'm looking forward to it, though. I've heard it's good.
It is absolutely brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. But the reason I ask is because the whole movie is set sort of from the start. It's Elton going into rehab, right? And it's him sort of like looking from rehab at the different aspects of his life. And Elton famously, I believe, tried to get you to go to rehab. Is that right?
I think I'd already been to rehab at that point, actually. But I remember we were out on tour in America and he phoned up and said, come and see me, I'm in Vegas. He was doing his Vegas residency. I went and met with him and we talked about it. And he said there are a lot of things because I think he'd read an interview in Q or something. And he said there were a lot of things about your story that really remind me of myself. Mm. And at the time, I think I still had a bit of work to do in terms of going out and doing some research into the world of addiction. So I sort of listened to what he had to say, but I don't think I was ready to hear it. Because it was probably 2006-07 when that meeting happened. But he was absolutely right. He could tell. And maybe he could also tell that I wasn't ready. So I think in the years after that, I sort of went off the rails on some rare occasions. I didn't think that it was a problem anymore. And it wasn't sort of then until sort of 2011-12 that the problems really started to resurface in a massive way. And he was absolutely right.
Now, guys, what's exciting for me about this reunion is that, Tim, you have been very clear. You're not a heritage act. You want to be releasing new music, more music, still be on the forefront. Because the thing is, you are so young when you actually think about the potential longevity of a band's career these days. So tell me, is this a permanent reunion?
I don't really know. I mean, I think it feels really fantastic at the moment. You know, I think we're enjoying and valuing each other as friends and musicians, you know, more than ever before, really. I think we've brought back so much from having a break. So, yeah, you know, I mean, I hope we can keep doing it. But, you know, at the same time, we've talked about Tom and his sort of the writing and, you know, and everyone else might have other stuff they want to do, you know.
But I guess you can do that now, though, can't you? Because you're out of that sort of phase where it's like you've got a record company on your back expecting an album every cycle. You know, potentially you could do Keane for a bit. Tom, perhaps you could do some solo work. Is that something you've thought about? You know, making having a balance between the two, which maybe you didn't get to have in that
first round. Yeah, I think what we all said at the beginning of this process when we come back is that we'd see how it went. You know, and as Tim says, things have been really good. I think for me, the best thing about it is that it's not been a heritage-y thing, as you say. It's the album has come about from this kind of very dark, sad, beautiful energy that's in these songs that Tim's written. So in terms of the actual music, I think it's something that feels very credible and like something we really wanted to say and get out there. So from that point of view, it's come from a really good place. And then I think the way it sounds as well, working with David Coston, who produced the record, he really challenged us and pushed us. And there was quite a lot of tension and conflict at times in the studio. But the result is a record that it's not like it's a record that has been made, you know, as though we're all in our comfort zone and just doing it to pay the bills or whatever. You know, it's got, for me, it's got real integrity. And I think that those are the elements of this, of doing this again, that are really appealing. Like it feels to me like there's integrity and a really positive energy and we're really saying something.
And you're proud of it.
And we're really proud of it, yeah. And I think that's the reason to do anything. So I think at the end of it, we just have to see how we feel and whether there's, you know, what the next thing is, what feels right to go and do. And it could be a solo thing for me, or it could be another Keane record. It could be something completely and utterly different. It might be we all need a rest for like 5 years. I don't know. I think it's very easy to get into a treadmill of doing things just because they're there in front of you and it's obvious, and, you know, treating it like a career. But I think that there's not as much merit in that. Mm. And I'm very much from the school these days of thinking, well, where's the energy? Where's the thing that's going to really excite me? And I think we just have to see what that is at the end of this touring cycle.
Absolutely. Well, Cause and Effect, it is out in September. Little bit of pressure because, of course, all four Keane studio albums have previously gone to number one. So let's hope this one does too. Yeah. Thank you so much for being here today, Tom and Tim.
Thanks, Dan.
Thank you. Please do remember to subscribe to the podcast. If you do that, you will get all of the episodes as soon as they become available. So many in our back catalogue, actually. James Corden, Ed Sheeran, The Spice Girls, and, of course, Madonna. Huge reaction to that interview. I actually think I had a lot of people say they thought it was the best interview she did for the promotional campaign of Madam X. And John Wesley agreed. He said, wow, amazing. Love Madonna and starting to love your interviewing skills, Dan. Thank you for that, John. Kenny West said, something strange is happening. I find myself agreeing with Madonna twice in the last few days. One, that modern music all sounds the same. And now that social media is turning people into slaves. This can't be right. He's talking about the fact that he agrees with her. No, she spoke a lot of sense in my interview. And Christopher A, he wrote in to say, I do believe that Madonna is the queen of pop. Still, her praises are all for old music released in the 80s and 90s. You can be the queen of pop and well past your prime. She was the Michael Jordan of pop music decades ago. MJ is still the greatest basketball player of all time, but I do not want to see him try to play against the youngsters tomorrow. Well, Christopher, I disagree, because Madam X is a fabulous album filled with really incredible pop songs that have an amazing message. And I think, despite the fact she is 60, Madonna is still producing amazing music, and long may she continue. But I do love to hear your feedback. Let me know what you think about the Keane interview. You can find me and comment on social media. Just head to my Facebook page, my Instagram page, or you can tweet me. You just need to search for @DanWooten on all of those. But thank you so much to listening to the Dan Wooten interview with Keane today. Please do subscribe, and I'll be back very soon with another A-List Chat.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.